For months thereafter, every man was employed in the digging of a channel to lead the sweet flood of water down the hillside and into the old wells. These now became storage cisterns for the settlement. When they brimmed over, Taita surveyed the old fields at the lower end of the valley that were now a stony desolation. However, the outlines of ancient irrigation ditches were still visible. Their levels had been set out by the old inhabitants, and it took small effort to clean out the contour lines and divert the overflowing waters into them. The desert earth was fertile. The goodness had not been leached out of it by heavy rainfall. The continuous sunshine and abundant water had a miraculous effect. They planted the millet seed smuggled in from Egypt. All Egyptians were farmers and gardeners by nature and tradition, and they lavished their skills upon the land and the crops. Within months, they'd reaped their first harvest of durra. Then they planted grass fields for grazing, which flourished and provided far beyond their present needs. The women joined in the cutting, drying, and stacking of fodder, and within the year they had sufficient to sustain an army of cavalry, though yet they lacked horses. Almost every day fugitives drifted into the city, having braved the desert crossing to escape the tyranny of the false pharaohs. They came singly or in small parties, weary and almost dying of thirst and starvation. The guards posted along the hills intercepted them and sent them into Hilto. He made them swear the oath of fealty to Pharaoh Nefertiti, then issued them with rations, and, depending on their suitability, sent them to the training regiments, or put them to work in the fields, or on restoring the dilapidated buildings of the old city. These waifs and foundlings were not the only recruits, however. A cohort of deserters from the armies of the false pharaohs marched in smartly with their javelins, shouting the praises of Nefertiti as soon as they were in sight of the walls. Then a squadron of 20 chariots, driven by crack troopers of the Ankh regiment, with a colonel named Timus at their head, came in under arms and joyously swore themselves in as liegemen of Pharaoh Nefertiti. Timus brought the momentous news that Najar and Trok were prepared at last to march on their combined offensive against King Sargon of Babylon and Assyria. Over the last few months, the two pharaohs had mustered their expeditionary force of 3,000 chariots at Avaris, and now they'd almost finished their preparations to cross the land bridge that linked Egypt with the eastern lands to the north of the Great Bitter Lake and Lake Timsa. First, they'd sent a column to drive in the Babylonian pickets along the border. Then, once the road was cleared, they'd shipped in tens of thousands of water jars in carts and wagons and placed them at strategically located storage stations across the dry lands. The country beyond was fertile and well watered. They planned to cross the land bridge in the full of the moon, using its light and the cool nights to sweep past Ismailia and up over the Hathma Pass and on to Beersheba, gathering up the forces of their vassal satraps as they went. Nefer and Taita had been preparing the defences of Galala against an imminent attack by the false pharaohs. They knew that their presence in the ancient city must now be common knowledge throughout the two kingdoms. They had confidently expected Najar and Trok to move against them first, before starting on the Mesopotamian adventure. Therefore, they were amazed to have this reprieve. "They have not taken seriously the threat that our presence so close to their borders poses," Nefer exulted. "If they'd attacked us now while we're still so weak, we'd have had no choice but to fly." "Perhaps they took that possibility into their calculations," Taita agreed. "Perhaps they're intent on conquering Mesopotamia and cutting off any support that we might have attracted in the Orient. Then they would have us surrounded. I think they have miscalculated, for they leave us to grow stronger for at least another year." "Can we be certain that this is not a diversion?" Nefer asked thoughtfully. "Is the Eastern expedition a pretense? Perhaps their true offensive will be directed against us after they've lulled us into a sense of false security." "There's always that possibility. Truk is a bull, but Naja especially is cunning and devious. It's the type of bluff he might try. Oh, we must keep the expeditionary army under observation, Nefer decided. I'll take a scouting party north to watch the road through Ismailia and make certain that they pass that way. I'll go with you, Taita agreed. No, Magus, Nefer demurred. You'll be best employed here to keep our defences alert and ensure that if Naja leads 3,000 chariots down upon us, the population is poised for instant flight. Also, there's another service I require of you. He hesitated. That's to care for Mintaka. I believe she might be discontented here with the other women and may attempt something unwise. Taita smiled. Precipitous action on the part of the princess is always a distinct possibility. However, I know well enough where my first duty lies. I will go with you. Although Nefer argued long and strenuously, Taita was adamant. And in the end, Nefer was secretly relieved to know that the old man would be at his side as always. Even with the latest arrival of troops to their cause, they could muster only 32 battle-ready chariots and less than 100 horses fit enough to draw them. They left half of the chariots under the command of Shabako to defend Galala. Taking Hilto and Merin with them, they set out with 16 fighting vehicles to drive around the eastern shore of the Great Bitter Lake and intercept the main route north of Ismailia. The new moon was only days past full, nights dark but pleasantly cool, so that they made good progress and completed the journey through the uncharted wilderness before the moon was into its second quarter.